Accession number 29167, reel number 4.
So we, fortunately, by this time, the weather was marvellous. So we had this wonderful, calm sea, and it was all very quiet.
This was the night of the.
That's right. The night of the fifth, sixth. That's right. And so the 40th minesweeping flotilla went down ahead of the Warspite. I can't remember the other ships, but ahead of the Warspite down, and then at some stage, all hell was let loose, in the sense that the Warspite started bombarding. There were air attacks and so on. And what had been calm and peaceful suddenly became hell on earth, really.
You could see the shore from where you were?
Oh, yes, indeed. By this time, it was getting light, but certainly the French coast was visible.
And you weren't sweeping at this stage, you were just there as...
We were sweeping down Channel 10, which, although it had been cleared by an earlier minesweeping flotilla called the Bangor flotillas, I think, there was still this requirement to make absolutely certain that we didn't really want to have a lose the Warspite or indeed anything else, but...
So you steamed forward of the Warspite.
Oh, yes. But then, as I say, I have to admit that another minesweeping flotilla had to be on ahead of us at some stage, an earlier stage, I think. I don't know that, I can't remember that detail. But theoretically, we were protecting these capital ships to get them. I can't remember at what stage, whereabouts they opened fire. But it was a sudden transformation, as you can imagine, from calm, peace, sea, vague outline of the French coast, and then woof, the whole earth came alive with this immense noise.
You knew by now what was going on, presumably.
Yes, I can't remember at what stage, but I think that by the Piccadilly Circus stage, we had to, really more than the commanding officer, the other people had to know, because we had to get into, we had special charts then, which we opened up, and we knew that we were going on Channel 10 to Sword Beach. Not that we went onto the beach, obviously, but then we turned, instead of going, then we were coming south onto the towards the beach, and then we turned and sort of cleared across the channel. But after that, you know, I don't really remember what happened. I don't remember at what stage. I don't remember escorting the Warspite back again. Because we were then, our responsibility then became keeping the area free, and then at night we formed a sort of, we anchored and formed a sort of a screen, because by that stage there was a threat of German E-boats being about, and we were theoretically meant to act as that screen against them,
because the troops wouldn't, the landings had taken place.
Yes,
now.
That's right. This is where I'm all very rather vague, I'm afraid. All I remember is that at one stage there was we anchored at night to form a static screen, which was quite nice. I mean, it was quite comfortable to anchor. But at one stage, an E-boat had got through or attacked something and sunk a ship. And so our mode changed from being anchored. Thereafter, at night, we had to sort of patrol. rather than anchor and go to sleep, as it were. And that there was a sort of pattern, really. I think we had 10 days on and 3 days off. And off meant going to Portsmouth. We could go across to Portsmouth for R&R. And this went on, I guess, until about August.
So, I mean, if we go down then, if we talk about the routine sweeping that you then had to do.
Yep.
What, you were always off Sword Beach or in that area off Normandy, and...
I think we extended our linked up with other minesweeping flotillas and conducted a rather larger area. We were covering a larger area than just the sheer Channel 10 down to Sword Beach, but I really don't recollect the detail of that.
You
fortunately,
which system you used more often, whether you used the acoustic mine,
my recollection of that is that we did quite a lot of wire, you know, Oropesa sweeping, and fortunately, it was a beautiful summer, and that was. And we didn't have any direct contact with the enemy. You know, we weren't attacked by anybody, not even by planes. I mean, our chummy flotilla, another flotilla, were attacked by planes at one stage, but we were not. We had really quite a peace, given the situation. We had quite a peaceful summer, really.
You said that you managed to tangle up the propeller of the ship.
Yes.
You had to slow down.
That was quite early on, I'm afraid, because I met Laura in Devonport on the 17th of July. we were in harbour for 4 nights, I think. So, you know, it was love at first sight, literally. Because I can only get off the ship, you know, a couple of times. Yes, I had an inglorious moment. As I say, we had 10 days on and 3 days off, and we came into Portsmouth, and unfortunately, our steering engines, our steering motors, were hardly working. We had to steer rather cumbersome way with engines, and as we were going up Portsmouth Harbour, a flotilla of destroyers, you know, very posh people those are, coming down, and the captain D, very haughtily signal to us with an Aldis lamp, "Get out of my bloody way." Well, it was difficult. So all we could think of to do was to drop anchor. At least we would be in one place because we couldn't really steer very well. And unfortunately, we dropped anchor on, and I was the navigating officer, so I should have got the blame for it. We dropped anchor on one of the main electric cables going across the harbour. So a lot of the harbour lights went out. But the inquiry did not place blame on HMS Gazelle. Fortunately, didn't place blame on anybody, really. But I remember that as something I'd prefer to forget, really. As I say, an inglorious moment. But most of the time, particularly, oddly enough, when we were sweeping mines, it was not very eventful.
And you did bring mines up, I mean...
Yes, we did. We exploded quite a few. One didn't count them in hundreds or anything. You know, you were very pleased if you got a handful of mines on a sweep. And one or two, particularly, I seem to remember the the acoustic hammer thing occasionally exploded in the mine rather closer than we would have liked. I didn't sink us or anything, but it shook a few things and jolted the fuse boards of the diesel electric engines, which are already rather sensitive. Initially, when the ships were sort of anglicised, as it were, they used to wire the I don't know what they're called, the fuses or contacts. I mean, otherwise, they would have gone off all. You know, we would have had failures all the time. But generally, we had a very comfortable, because I quite liked living on a ship, particularly if one was by that time I was a sub lieutenant, even, you know. So I slept in a bunk. I don't know what happened to my hammock. I haven't thought about my hammock since those days, really. But I wasn't sorry to see it go, if indeed it went. But by that time, I was very much at home on the Gazelle, which was home, really. We went to various, I mean, the August time, we went on to the east coast of Scotland, leaving the Normandy area, and did what I would call, you know, sort of routine sweeping across to the Skagerrak and so on, because there were so many mines being littered about there.
In terms of the ship itself, I mean, what kind of drills did you have for you know, mine, if a mine was spotted, or there must have been a special process, because the minesweeper was probably the most likely to get to strike a mine to evacuate the ship or to cope with it. What can you remember any of those that were special to a minesweeper, the drills? Or
I'm not sure I can. That's terrible, isn't it? No, we were. I don't recall that we had to invoke. I mean, as you can imagine, we went in a sort of chevron formation, ship by ship, there was a lot of exchange of information. I mean, any time a mine was raised, the ship which had raised it obviously informed the flotilla. But I don't remember much about that.
You were in line of sight, presumably. You
can. Oh yes,
you
yes.
Had to be to keep station.
That's right. Yes, and normally. And I'm looking for an excuse here. Normally, I was busy keeping station, because that was fairly critical, and with rangefinder and that sort of thing. I loved that. I loved being on the bridge of this little ship. You know, it was a marvelous experience for me. Marvelous experience for me. And after a time, I got my watchkeeping certificate. You know, I felt at home there, really.
And your navigation, I mean, it was an extraordinary responsibility to be navigating this ship with the elementary training that you've been given.
Oh, indeed. Fortunately, as I say, a lot of it was line of sight. So that, because on the whole, we didn't do much sweeping at night. You know, it's a mainly daylight operation. After the end of the war, We escorted Crown Prince Olaf back to Oslo. You know, our flotilla provided the screen ahead of. My recollection, which may not be very exact, is that he was on the mine layer Apollo, and we took him to Oslo. And stayed there a couple of nights. And there were still pockets of German soldiers around. Not that we were expected doing about that, but we came alongside, and it felt as if the whole of Oslo came on board. It really was the most extraordinary experience.
But this is after the war. This is
well, it's it was just after, you know. Yes, that's right. Just after the war, it was, I guess, in June 45 or something. I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead a bit there, but that is again a vivid memory, but it's all part and parcel of the business of just sweeping the mines which were littered around the seas between us and the rest of Europe.
Why? I mean, perhaps a naive question, but why didn't your minesweeper set off mines? Because it was going through. Did it have any anti-mine gear that prevented it from blowing up? Or was it?
Well, the on the whole, we had information. Yeah, we had degassing. That's true. But also, of course, there were plots, there were maps of where mines had been laid. For the most part, I mean, obviously, some mines were laid by air, sort of maliciously. You're quite right. The leader, who's usually the senior officer. We had a commander in charge of the flotilla, we had degaussing, but that's a good point. But I think the minefields were plotted on the whole. But I don't. You see, again, it shows really how little I remember. I don't remember the being aware of the danger of the fact that we were trying to cut mines behind us, and we might have been hitting mines ahead of us.
Was there any particular sort of mine that was known for its, you know, being very, very dangerous or particularly lethal?
I don't recall that, I have to say. I don't recall that. There were such mines, but I don't remember that, I have to say. It was a fascinating business. And again, it shows the insensitivity of youth. I have no recollection of any sense of danger, really. You know, it was a very absorbing business, particularly, as I say, because I was on the bridge and I was sort of trying to keep our ship in the right place. And
do you think the ship was a happy ship? I mean, you said the captain was a bit of a fiend. Do you think the ship, but as a relatively small group of, what, 100 men or so?
Yeah.
Did it have a good reputation or good feeling? Or?
I don't I certainly have no recollection of a ship seething with discontent or unhappiness and so on. They were, of course, as I say, a lot of that depended, I think, on the very high quality of the petty officers. I had such an admiration for them. And most of them were regulars. I mean, the coxswain, the chief petty officer on our ship, I mean, he was an absolute rogue, but he was so good at his job and at running the ship, you know. I mean, one of the jobs I had was to censor letters going out written by the ship's crew. And this chap used to write to about three or four different wives, you see what I mean. But yet he was so good at his job, so clever, so bright, and so loyal. Of course, I think he liked having a regular officer in command, They were the people who ran the ship, really. And I can understand that. And thank goodness somebody did. But he was a very young man. I mean, he was in his, certainly not more than early 30s, I'm sure. But he was a really top-rate chap. So I think the running of the ship played an important part in the level of contentment, really. And he ran it very well. But as I say, he had more or less a wife in every port.
You say you went into Plymouth in July because the ship you tangled up. How did you get back? What happened?
We could go at low revs.
With all this wire.
Mm. Well, I think.
Or it snapped off and it was just wrapped around.
Yeah, I think yes. We certainly, I suppose, crawled back, which took a long time. But then, we couldn't do anything else, really.
Were submarines still a danger at this point?
I'm not sure, because we would have been largely in more or less coastal waters. So I don't think we didn't get onto the high seas, really. I don't remember that. I mean, we had... We carried out regular ASDIC sweeps, but I don't think we ever encountered anything like that. But say we went into Devonport.
And what was your impression of Plymouth? Because it had been fairly knocked about.
Yes, yes.
I suppose it might have been tidied up by 44 because the major raids were in 42.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, yes. There was still. My main impressions of Plymouth really were superseded by my impressions of Laura.
Was she a Plymouth girl? Or was she in
the she was actually living in Tavistock because her house in Plymouth had been bombed. But she came down one evening for one of Lady Astor's dances at the Continental, which is now the New Continental Hotel. And I was persuaded. I didn't dance then. I don't dance now. But I was persuaded to go ashore with a couple of my colleagues to this dance. And she went with a friend of hers. And they were due to meet some American officers, I think, but the Americans didn't turn up. So they took us on as second best. And it was, So it's partly a joke, but it's partly said. I didn't really think much about Plymouth itself. I liked it because this wonderful girl lived there, and I was living on the ship, of course, comfortably on the ship. But when we were married, I stayed. This was a year or so later. Well, I stayed in the officers' club, which was then on Lockyer Street, and that was fun. But we and at that time we used to travel on the trams were still running, you see, and I love trams, and we had an interesting collection of people. One of them was a young man in the navy, an ordinary seaman, as it happened, but he was a classical scholar, and he embarrassed us to some extent by translating the regulations about which are pinned up on in the tram into Latin, and of course the rest of the passengers, I don't think they thought that was very amusing, but it amused us, but embarrassed us too. Really, his name was Polyansky, brilliant chap. However, that really is, by the way.
Going back then you've covered the D-Day landings. You then get into this routine of sweeping the area,
yep.
And then you go up to the east coast of Scotland and continue,
yep,
sweeping across there. How conscious of you were the success of the European war? Were you informed that, things...
Oh, yes.
You knew that the end was nigh. It was...
Yes, we were at sea most of the time leading up to that, because we were sweeping across, to the Skagerrak. But we were waiting, perhaps almost impatiently, for the actual word of the German surrender. partly because I think we then were ordered to spice the main brace. So we had a rather drunken ship's company for a time.
Where was that? Were you at sea?
We were at sea, yes, yes. Fortunately, the coxswain, this rogue that did, he was at the wheel, and so we were able to keep a reasonably straight course.
But what happened? The signal came, it was expected, and it came through?
Yes.
On the radio?
That's right, yes, we had a signal. We had a signal. I don't think it came from the senior officer by Idi the Umpty, but I think we had a radio signal, or maybe we got it from the senior officer by Aldous Lamp. But whatever, you know, it was expected, but nonetheless, it was a wonderful feeling when it came. But as it happened, being a minesweeper, it didn't affect us. We didn't just down tools, because we were just going on, and we went on doing that for months afterwards, of course.
So, I mean, that's a whole year we've covered, really. Is there anything that really stands out in that year, apart from meeting your wife, of course, from 44 to 45? Any sort of particular incident or, you know, contact or that you think is important that we haven't talked about?
That's good.
This routine of 10 days on, 3 days off, 10 days on, 3 days off, that was
a routine. Yes, it was. Yes, yes. I won't say, I mean, one is tempted to say it was enjoyable, but of course the weather was so good that, you know, standing on the bridge of a ship, conning it was a job. But why? What a job, you know. It was for me. I wouldn't say it was pride. I suppose a sense of pride, but it was something that I would never have conceived a couple of years ago that I would ever do, you know. So in that sense, and I come to terms with the captain by then. He was almost a chum. The whole thing, and the work. I, strangely enough, as I've said before, I didn't have any real sense of danger. It was a sense of achievement. So, you know, when we got, because you didn't get, as I again said before, you didn't get hundreds of mines popping up. So when you got a mine popping up or a mine exploded down, it was an event, you know. But it usually, invariably, almost invariably, didn't present danger to you. We did occasionally, when we were early on in the after the DD invasion, we were involved in, because people ships were being sunk, you know, they're not ours massively. So we were pulling bodies out of the sea and so on, which was again grisly, but inevitable in a way, you know. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that there was so little of this. I was unlike the soldiers on the beaches, you know. I escaped most of this. Occasionally, one went to try and pick up survivors from ships and that sort of thing. And that there was a lot of blood and bodies there, but that was the exceptional event, whereas, as I say, for the soldiers on the shore, that was everyday life, wasn't it, or everyday death. So that, in a way, and I don't want to make light of this, but in a way, that rather justified my choice of the Navy when I was a 17-year-old to do my bit, as it were. It's something I certainly have no regret about, and it was a wonderful experience.
Can we finish off now? I suppose we've got the end of the war.
Right.
You've spliced the main brace. The ship is weaving around the.
yes.
Then you know that for you. I mean, it's also the war is over. Ernest Noble, Reel 5.
Yep.
What happens next? after the end of hostilities. You continue to sweep, you're continuing to
clean up.
Does the technology change at all? Are there new methods
brought
in?
Not that I'm aware of, no. We're still, as far as I'm, we certainly didn't, it might have been, there may have been some refinements to the electrics of the system or something like that, but I don't recollect, we weren't fitted with new equipment, as far as I know. We went on using the old equipment because we were fighting the old mines, really, you see what I mean. We moved around from the east coast of Scotland. We were working out of Aberdeen across to Scandinavia. We then moved around to the west coast of Scotland to work between Iceland and Greenland. There had been sort of fairly heavy laying of mines along some of those routes.
Where the water's quite, it's very deep up there, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes. We didn't go across to Greenland. We worked off from Iceland. And presumably, and we certainly went into some of the fjords. Maybe some of the fjords had been mined, I don't know. But we anchored off Reykjavik for a time, and then around the corner to Seyðisfjörður. That was interesting, you know, that because there was the war ended by then, and the Icelanders, they were not unfriendly, but they weren't very welcoming. They were worried about they didn't like the fact that so many sailors were on shore. When there were so many pretty women about. I mean, the Icelandic ladies are particularly attractive, and I enjoyed Iceland for that, among other reasons. But I remember the naval handbook, which marvellously informative book, BRs are called, about Iceland, said prostitution is unknown, but promiscuity is common in the towns. And this Periotta Coxon, he said, well, sir, that means they're all amateurs. But it was, but that, that, I mean, so we spent a little time there, but and off the west coast of Alt, we were at Alt Bay, which is Loch Hugh, down there. That was after the end of the war in Japan as well.
And you took the King Olaf back to Norway as well. You talked briefly about that. Can you talk a little bit more detail about that? You picked him up where on the east coast of Scotland? And
We joined up. He was already on a ship. I think it's the Apollo, but I don't know. And so we joined up before it was still in friendly waters. And we, as I say, we preceded him across the North Sea to Oslo, and we stayed there two or three nights. I think they were fairly hectic, but I say the interesting thing is that it was close enough to the end of the war in Europe for there still to be the odd pocket of German soldiers. I don't understand that. We didn't encounter them, of course, but they were
still fighting. Or
well, the odd shot was fired. I think they were a bit half-hearted about it. Both sides, really, you know, because the Norwegians just wanted to get on with their lives, and the Germans knew they hadn't a hope in hell of doing anything other than surrendering. But I think they fired a few shots. But they were it's strange that is. That is a memory I have, not of grappling with German soldiers, but of hearing the odd shots and people saying, oh, well, there are a few Germans up there. But that was a pleasant little interlude, really. But I seem to remember that one of my uniforms was ruined by a Norwegian lady accidentally pouring a bottle of avocado over it, and it's very difficult stuff to get off. But I didn't resent it. After all, she was, you know, she was, she had just, her country had just been liberated.
And the ship, you said, you must have been very popular in steaming into it.
Oh, yeah, and there were several ships, of course.
Yeah.
But they, everyone, I mean, we, a policy decision was made that we would invite Oslovians, or whatever they're called, to come on board the ship. But I'm not sure we'd anticipated quite so many would come. But that was, yeah, that was, I can't remember the exact date, but it was shortly after the end of the war in Europe, certainly.
So then we go to the end of the war in Japan, and now, I suppose, what are you thinking about your future? Were you tempted to if you liked it so much, were you given the opportunity to...